Blog Talk Radio.
Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Not so mad science. You know, there was one time before where I explained the purpose of the name of Not So Mad Science and how this show came about. And I think it's time that we revisit that explanation and revisit a basic understanding of what the sciences are. Can be broken down in terms of the science that it reflects. But all too often, as we discussed last week, that how does a parent who not as well educated as their child, or a parent who doesn't quite understand the educational processes that are in at work today in comparison to the way they were taught, how does that parent help that child excel in school? If we left things up to the public school system, will our child be successful? If left up to the public school system, will our child be educated in a manner in which the creative drive in that child can come forward? So we have this show. We come on once a week, every Tuesday at 6:30 p.m., Not So Mad Science, where what is seen to be unexplainable, what is perceived to be difficult to understand. Public medium is beyond our grasp. It's made simple and understandable. Every mother that goes into the kitchen to cook is a chemist. Every father to work every day and labors with his hands is an engineer. Every individual that goes out into the workforce applies some form of science in the aspects of their daily activities. Thus, this program, Not So Mad Science, where we take the difficult to be understood and we make it simple. So tonight's show, we're going to give the broad brush stroke. And I encourage you, the listeners to Not So Mad Science, to do a little homework on yourself. Get a dictionary and look the words up so that then you can offer an explanation to your young ones coming behind you that are going to need some help or that will need a greater understanding than they get when they're in school. How is math applied on an everyday basis such that math is no longer seen as difficult? It only helps that when we can take theory and we can show its practical practice in our daily lives, thus the difficult becomes simple. So, to make things smooth, start off with physics. Why physics? Physics is perceived as being the more difficult of the basic sciences. So we're going to make it a little bit simpler. When we look around us and examine the objects found in our home, in the street, in the stores, and in the workplace, and in nature everywhere, we realize that things with which we are surrounded are made of a greater variety of materials. Chemists have found that all complex substances, the water around us, the air we breathe, are mixtures of chemical compounds. Nearly a million compounds have been identified. And these, in turn, are merely different combinations of only about 100 chemical elements known to science, things we use every day. There are three basic forms of matter that we know of. Some of the substances we meet are solid. Iron or stone. These are solid. Others are liquids. Water, oil. Still others are gases. Air, steam. These are called the three basic conditions: solid, liquid, and gas of matter. But there is a stage that is confusing. That is a semi-solid, or a semi-liquid, or semi-gas. These things that are, they have a solid surface as well. If one could imagine clay. But imagine that clay as a flowable plastic that can be molded, yet moves like water. Is it a solid or is it a liquid? It is in that state that stands between solid and liquid. Just as ice, which is water, is a solid, is also steam in another state. Solid, liquid, or gas. A solid object can be thought of as one that tries to keep a definite shape in a definite bulk. Well, where the confusion can come in, when we look at glass, we would say that glass is a solid. Is it? When you look at a piece of glass and you examine that piece of glass very, very closely, a piece of glass that has been sitting in a window frame for a very long time is thicker at the bottom edge than it is at the top and in the middle and along the side. How is that possible if the glass is solid? Glass in that form of silicates under pressure, heat, mixed with other minor ingredients that form the glass when brought to a particular temperature, melt. This melted material turns into glass. But that glass, when dried, becomes brittle. Yet it is still soft enough that over time will continue to flow like water. It can be broken into pieces. It can be cut. But it is an extremely slow moving. Try it one day. You need a specialized type of measuring equipment, a caliper, where you can then measure the thickness of the glass at the base, and then you measure that same piece of glass at the top. You will see the variation in thickness in any old piece of glass in a window. But a liquid positioned to a solid, a liquid will take on the shape of any container into which it is poured. It has no form. It has no shape. It takes the shape of that which contains it. Whereas a gas, on the other hand, has neither a definite shape nor a definite volume. If some air is let into a chamber or a room of some type that was recently pumped out, this quantity of air will fill the whole space uniformly, unlike water in a jar. A gas does not have a distinct surface. So when we explain the basic rudiments of physics to our young ones, we think in terms of the three forms of matter: solid, liquid, and gas. Once again, this is Not So Mad Science, and I'm your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. If you would like to call in and ask a question, I encourage you to do so. That call-in number is 563-999-3089. Once again, the call-in number, if you have a question that you'd like to put out there, that number is 563-999-3089. And for our long-time listeners, the number is still active, 323-927-2913. Once again, that's 323-927-2913. Common substances as mixtures of matter in several states. Fine sand or silt mixed with water will not settle out. It forms what is called a colloidal suspension. What does that mean? It is a stable mixture of a solid and a liquid. What is an example that you use every day of a colloidal mixture? As in the ink and the pen, milk is described as an emulsion, globule of one liquid, fat suspended in another liquid called water. Foam, the foam you see in your hot chocolate or your specialized coffee from Starbucks or some other place, the foam is a gas suspended in a liquid. Often we know a single kind of matter in all three principal states. Water is a common example. Ordinarily, water is in a liquid form, but at very low temperatures, it goes into a solid state that we call ice. At high temperatures, it becomes a steam, a mist, which is the name for the gaseous state of water. We usually think of air as a gas. But at 300 degrees below zero, it turns into a bluish liquid, the air you breathe. Iron, for example, commonly seen in its solid state, becomes a liquid in a foundry and a gas in the sun and in the stars, where the temperature is many thousands of degrees. But you never imagine a piece of iron as a gas. You're comfortable with the idea of iron at high temperatures being a flowable liquid poured into a form to create a shape. But you never thought that a piece of iron can also be a gas. These are all the physical changes and the material keeps its identifying characteristics all the while. But when a piece of wood burns or a piece of concrete hardens or cream turns sour, there is in each case a more permanent change and a new substance is formed. These are examples of chemical changes in physical properties. I'm going to say that again. When wood burns, or concrete or cement hardens, or the cream turns sour in your milk, there is in each case a more permanent change and a new substance is formed. These are examples of chemical changes, physical properties. So what are the general characteristics of matter? In studying physics, we are not especially interested in the special properties of the many kinds of matter that exist. It would be the business of a chemist. But what a physicist is interested in, what do we want to find out about, are the general characteristics common to all kinds of matter. One of these is shows that we can neither manufacture nor destroy matter. I call that the God factor. You can neither manufacture or create, nor can you destroy that which exists. One of these characteristics is called permanence. You can neither manufacture or destroy matter. All you are able to do is change it from one stage of existence to another by a chemical process. Another general fact about matter is the obvious one, space. No two things can occupy the same space at the same time lest they become combined to create something else. A boat in the water pushes the water aside as it passes. Chisel forces apart the very fibers of a block of wood. Even air acts to keep other intruding materials out. And here's a basic experiment you can do. You can float a small cork on water in a bowl down over it. The water surface inside the glass is found to be pushed down, which you can see in the change in position of the cork. The same principle applies to the air pumped into a suit of a deep sea dive, or into what is called a caisson for people who work underwater, which is used in underwater construction. Sometimes we meet situations where two pieces of matter do seem to occupy the same space. That is an illusion, but there's an experiment that you can do with that as well. You can fill a glass to the brim full of water, add salt from a salt shaker, and a little at a time, with care, a considerable amount of salt can be put in without making the water overflow. Explains with this unseeming phenomena. The explanation is that water, in fact, any substance, is not continuous matter. There are spaces, void between the individual molecules of water, into which other molecules, as in this case the salt, can enter that space and sit there. There's another general property of material bodies that we shall have more to do with later on in our discussion. It is called inertia. I-N-E-R-T-I-A. Inertia. In some respect, this is the most fundamental of all the attributes of matter. It can be easily described as the tendency for any object to stay at rest, means stay still, not move, not exhibit any form of motion. If it is at rest now, in motion, to continue moving as it is now until something what? Stops it. When a car in which you are sitting starts up suddenly, you find yourself falling backwards into the seat. Nothing in the car actually pushed you backwards, but your body merely tried to stay at rest. It tried to stay still as it was originally. But if after getting underway, if after moving with the car, the brakes are applied, your body begins to pitch or to move forward. Your body obviously tried to resist previous motion. There's another simple experiment that you can do. Place a rock or a bucket of sand on a board resting on two pieces of pipe so that it can roll. Tie one end of a piece of heavy cord to the weight and wrap around the other end a few times onto a short stick so you can grip it. A gentle pull on the string will make the board and the load which sits on it, the sand in the bucket, will glide along easily. And once in motion, it will tend to keep going. But a sudden sharp jerk will break the string while hardly moving the weight at all. Once in motion, tendency to keep moving. But when at rest, it strongly opposes any attempt to get in motion. Once again, dear friends, this is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. We're going to take a brief commercial break, and we'll be right back.
No more sleeping in bed, no more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up, all the teachers, come to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up, and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Na 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 na. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now. Just you and me. Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the hair. But they don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away? Wake up all the builders, time to build a new land. I know we could do it if we all lend a hand. The only thing we have to do is put it in our minds. Surely things will work out, they do it every time. The world won't get no better if we just let it be. No, 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 no. The world won't get no better. We gotta change it now, just you and me.
Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Talking about physics, and we're giving a basic idea of physics to continue through with the theme of Not So Mad Science, so that we're not afraid of sciences when we go to school. We're not too afraid to hear things or discomforted by discussions of the sciences by those around us in the workplace or things of that nature in public. We don't have to feel out of place. We'll be able to stand in line, so to speak, and give our thoughts on it. And give our thoughts on it intelligently, because the science has a real world application to it. We can comprehend. We understand. And our lack of understanding is only because someone didn't teach us the proper way. So in sticking with physics, we're going to look at mass and weight. We got a cognizant idea now of the three states of matter, which are the broad structure of what physics represents. Now we're going to look at weight and mass. Again, our experience points to the fact that the heavier a body is, the more it shows this property of inertia. Now, what we call the weight of a body is simply the amount of pull of the Earth's gravity on it. This means that a body has weight only because it happens to be near a very large object, like the Earth. Standard 1 pound weight is moved farther from the Earth's surface, it weighs less. The Earth does not pull on it quite so hard. But if you think about the last experiment that I described and others of a similar kind, you see that they would work equally well if the whole setup were far away from the Earth. Inertia effects cannot depend directly on the weight of an object or a body as such. They are found to depend only on the amount of matter in the body, and this is called its mass. Now, I need you to pay close attention, because what sounds difficult actually is quite easily and simply grasped. So I need you to listen closely. The weight of a body depends on how near to the Earth it is, while its mass would be the same anywhere in the universe, provided only that nothing is taken away from it or added to it. For example, two bricks together has twice the mass of a single brick. A pair of bricks could put on, or could be put on a spring scale at rest 1,600 miles above the Earth's surface. Their weight would be found only to be about that of a single brick at sea level. And finally, inertia of a body depends only on its mass or how much material there is in it. Therefore, the greater the mass, the greater the inertia. There's a term in here that's not being applied that I'm going to add to it, and it's called density. And the easy way to describe it is to go into the kitchen when you're making cream of wheat or oatmeal. The more water used in the boiling process and you pour your cream of wheat or oatmeal in, the thinner it is. Therefore, when you eat it, a bowl of oatmeal with a lot of water is thin. Therefore, it doesn't have quite as much mass. It doesn't hang quite so heavy in your stomach. But that same bowl of oatmeal with less amounts of water is thicker. Therefore, it is heavier. So it is denser. So if you eat a full bowl of that, it weighs heavy in your stomach. Density together. For those who have the chore of taking out the garbage. You don't want to take out the garbage. Well, the garbage can is not full. So you take your foot, put it in the garbage can, and you push the stuff down. You pack it in tighter so you can put more stuff into the garbage bag. That garbage bag has not grown inside the garbage can. You're just packing it with more stuff. Therefore, it is denser because it is being compacted. Finally, pull the bag out. The bag is still the same size as it was in the can, only because it packed it tighter, it is denser. So when you pull it out, it is heavier because of its density. Which now forces us to look at the various forms of energy, which are a part of this broad science called, besides matter, there are other things that we deal with in physics. Things like electricity, light, sound, heat. And there's a very interesting thing I'm going to talk to you about in a few minutes about heat. electricity, light, sound, and heat. These are not the kinds of matter. They're not kinds of matter. For they neither take up space, nor do they have any identifiable weight in the usual sense. These are forms of energy. Energy is something that produces changes in matter. You can see that heat can change water from a liquid to a gas, for example. Light from the sun can fade the dye in clothes or form an image on a film in your camera. Electrical energy can turn a motor, put silver plating on a spoon, or send your voice over thousands of miles in space. Then there's chemical energy. Where energy heats your home, runs your car. And the action of atomic energy is known to everybody. Probably the most familiar energy effects are the ones that are able to make bodies move or change their motion. It is also known as mechanical energy and has been called the go of things. A machine of any kind, whether it is a simple hand tool or a printing press or an airplane, puts mechanical energy to work. A little later on, hopefully, we'll learn how physicists measure energy exactly, if we have enough time. But before we can measure anything as intangible as energy, to learn first how to measure simpler things. Physics, as a rule, is known as an exact science. And this means that it is possible to make precise measurement of the things we talk about. We must not only know how to describe events and things, but we also be able to answer the question, how? How much? What? Where? And why? From the earliest times, people have found ways of specifying quantities, such as the this time between important events or the amount of goods bought and sold. To do this, we set up systems of measurements based on convenient units of measure or common units of measure that are mutually agreed upon. There are many types of measurement. Some of these are very direct and simple. Others require great care in the use of highly complex instruments. But whatever it is that you wish to measure with, you can do so only in terms of some chosen unit of measure. And the unit must be the same kind of thing as the quantity that is to be measured. For example, take the simplest kinds of measuring operations. Finding the length of an object. Before you can express the result, you must have a length unit. Easily described as the inch, yard, or the mile. The size of the unit is arbitrary, because those are just words. You may choose it in any way you like, but once you select it, you must stick to it as it then becomes the standard by which you measure. Many historians are not absolutely certain how the standard yard was originally selected. But that's not what is important at this particular moment. In the English system of measure, which is used here in the United States, of which we are most familiar, it is used in civil affairs of all or most English-speaking countries, the standard yard. Between the end marks of a certain bronze bar kept in a vault at the office of the Exchequer in London, it is assumed all goods sold by length are measured by a stick or a tape that has been marked off according to the standard yard. Though copies that are kept in the bureaus of standards of various countries. Inches, yards, and miles. I mentioned those. Why have more than one length or unit? Why do we have all these other lengths and units? All these other terms? If we have inches, why do we need yards? If we have yards, why do we need miles? Why don't we measure the speed of cars in yards per hour? But we say miles per hour. And it was simply for convenience sake. To describe the length of a pencil, the inch would be the most suitable unit. To give the distance between cities, we use the mile. The pencil could be measured in miles, but the number you would get would be ridiculously small in terms of its decimal equivalent. Similarly, expressing the distance between towns in inches would lead to an inconveniently large number. Always trying to choose a unit that is not too different in order of magnitude from the thing you are measuring. So we have inches, yards, feet, and miles simply to describe the convenience of the object or item or the distance being measured to best describe it in numerical terms that do not exceed the limits of comprehension. Describe something in 1,600,250 inches, doesn't make sense. It's easier just to say 25 miles. But there's another system of measurement out there that is used by most of the developed world. The metric system, the meter. Whereas 1 inch is roughly 2.5 centimeters. In the English speaking world, we say 1 inch. In the rest of the world, they would say 2.5 centimeters. The sizes of various length units in the English system do not seem to be related in any simple way. As I said before, they are arbitrary. And it is necessary to remember that there are 12 inches in 1 foot, 3 feet in 1 yard, 5,280 feet in a mile, and so on. This makes it difficult to change a measurement from one unit to another. It would be much simpler if we had a system where all conversions would be multiples of 10. Then in order to change units, you would only have to move the decimal point the proper number of places. Such a system or scheme was set up about 150 years ago, and it's called the metric system. It is now the accepted system of measure in all scientific work in all countries. I'm going to say that again. The metric system is now the accepted system of measure all scientific work in all countries throughout the world. The fundamental length unit in the metric system is the standard meter. It is the distance between the end of a certain bar of platinum alloy kept at the International Bureau of Weights and Measures in France. Copies of this bar are carefully kept in other countries. The meter is a little longer than a yard, where a yard is 36 inches, the meter is 39.37 inches, to be precise. If I could describe the table as it looks on paper, 1 kilometer is 1,000 meters. 1 meter, or the primary unit, as I already stated, is 39.37 inches. 1 centimeter, 0.1 meter. 1 millimeter is 0.001. Whereas 1 kilometer, or the metric mile, is equal to 0.621 miles. And to be precise, and where I've already stated that physics is a precise science, 1 meter is exactly 39.4 inches. And 1 centimeter is exactly 2.5 more centimeters, is equal to 1 inch. Easy it is to translate meters as size grows simply by shifting your decimal plate over to the left or to the right. Whereas dealing with inches, 12 inches to the foot, 3 feet to the yard. But you cannot describe 1 mile in terms of yards. To describe it in terms of feet, 5,280 feet. There is no yard equivalent to the mile in terms of how many feet that is. Suppose a rug was measured as 0.0012 kilometers long. This is a small decimal, and it would be easier to judge the size of the result if it were written in terms of a smaller unit, say the centimeter. Since there are 100 centimeters in a meter and 1,000 in a kilometer, there will be 100 times 1,000, 100,000 centimeters in a kilometer. Then our 0.0012 kilometer will amount to 0.0012 times 100,000. Or simply moving the decimal point 5 places to the right to multiply by 100,000. Or to 120 centimeters. Equally well, we would write it as 1.2 meters. By comparison, how much more arithmetical work is needed to change, say, 1.47 miles to inches? There are 12 inches to 1 foot, 5,280 feet in a mile. So we have to multiply all three numbers together to get the result. 12 times 5,280 times 1.47 equaling 93,100 inches. Now you got to notice, incidentally, that while actual multiplication gives us 93,139.2, I rounded it off to 93,100. This is because the 1.47 is given only to three significant digits. So it would be meaningless to write the final result to any more than this number. This remark applies regardless of where the decimal point happens to come in a final result. This is why. Now, all this sounds very confusing, doesn't it? And, well, it should. This is why the scientific world chose the meter as the standard unit of measure for all scientific work, because it is a number multipliable and divisible by 10 at all stages. Being what it is, we're not limited by the application of the science. Physics also looks at the solid state of objects. Thus, physicists deal with geometry. In order to measure the area or surface, we need an arbitrary unit that is itself an area. It is simplest to choose this area to be a square and can avoid introducing anything really new by making the side of the square equal in length to one or more length area measurement. We have square inches, square feet, square centimeters, square kilometers, etc. To write abbreviation for the area of units we use, exponent. Now, for our children that are in school and they're taking algebra and some of the other higher forms of mathematics, we hear this term exponent. Do not let the term exponent throw you. It means it is a shorthand notation or a shorthand writing to describe something simple or something dramatic. I won't say hard, I'll just say more dramatic. An exponent. Square centimeters is written as cm to a postscript 2, which is above it. Cm with the little 2 written above the m on the right side of the m, which means squares. anything squared itself times itself. What is 2 squared? 2 squared is 2 times 2, which is 4. What is 4 squared? 4 times 4, which is what? 16. And I'll leave that for you mathematicians to deal with. Square inches is written as inches squared, and so on. But these abbreviations are still to be read aloud as square centimeters and square inches. An example would be, how many square centimeters are there in a rectangular strip of film that is 1 1/8 inches wide and 40 inches long? What would the solution be mathematically? The area of the film in square inches is 1 1/8 inch times 40 equals 40 inches squared. Say by 6.45 gives the result of 290 centimeters squared. We also have bulk or volume measurement. Or volume requires a cubical unit for its measurement. We're still talking about physics now. But you need the science of geometry and algebra to calculate in terms of physical properties with regard to space and volume. There are cubic centimeters, cubic feet. What is the representation of that? 2 cubed, whereas 2 squared is 2 times 2, 2 cubed is 2 times 2 times 2. Cubed is what? 8. Okay? In all, volume measurement goes very much like length and area. There's a special name given to a metric unit of volume equal to 100 centimeters cubed, and it is called a liter. And it is just a little bit larger than a quart. So when you go to the store and you buy a 1 liter bottle of fluid, you're looking at 100 centimeters squared, cubed. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We are now 38 minutes after the hour. We're going to take another brief commercial break, and we'll be right back. And while we are in that commercial break, we want to listen to a little bit of Billy Paul.
Oh, know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. We meet every day at the same cafe, 6:30, and no one knows she'll be there. Holding hands, making all kinds of plans, while the jukebox plays a favorite song. Me and Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, Mrs. Jones, we got a thing going on. We both know that it's wrong, but it's much too strong to let it go now. Well, it's time for us to believe it. It hurts so much inside. Now she'll go her way, and I'll go mine. Tomorrow we'll meet the same place, the same
Welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're doing a lot of discussion about the physical properties of matter and how they're measured and why we have the measuring tools that are used to describe the physical environment about around us. And we're beginning to run out of time, and I don't want to lose sight of the purpose of this. So I'm going to come back next week, and we're going to go into chemistry. And the week after that, we're going to close out this discussion with a conversation about biology. When each of us walked out our doors over these last 3 days, we were hit with fundamental force of nature called wintertime. Some had to shovel snow, some used a snowblower, but everybody got a bit of snow if you're here in Detroit. The temperature is very low, and we say it is cold outside. But can anyone tell me what cold is? And I'll give you a moment to get to your dictionaries or to go to your Google search engines and give me a definition of cold that is legitimately real. And after you give that definition, I'm going to explain to you in no uncertain terms that you have just to yourself, through lack of understanding, a lie. Whole is a perception, but it is not a real reality. I'm going to repeat that once again. It is a perception and not a reality. How and why can we say that cold is a fictitious construct of our thoughts? It is a fakery, a non-actual thing that we convinced ourselves through lack of understanding actually exists. You don't need to be a physicist, chemist, biologist, mathematician, or any person in the high sciences to deal with the idea, or philosopher, to deal with the idea that cold is not an actual property. That is not to say that if you go outside uncovered in a coat, shoes, socks, gloves, hat, scarf, sweater, hoodie, or some covering, that you will not end up freezing to death and in the hospital suffering from hypothermia, frostbite, or some other condition because you expose yourself to the external temperature outside. To say that it is cold is wrong. Cold is a faux pas of our thinking. To describe a condition simply to give it a term, but it's not an actuality. Why? We know that where there is movement, there is friction. How do we know? If you take your hands and you rub them together, it starts to get warm. Friction. We know that when a car is running down the road at high speed and you put your hands on that tire, even though that wheel is rolling along the road, it is generating heat because of the friction, the contact point where the rubber meets the road. We know that if you take your finger and you slide it across a piece of ice, where your ice, the ice melts. Friction. As a result of what? Heat. Where there is movement, there is friction. Where there is friction, there is heat. So why did we come up with this term cold to describe the environment, and science says that cold does not really exist? What we call cold simply is the absence of heat, but there is still thermal action taking place. When you take an ice crystal, which we call snow, and we look at it under a microscope, a very powerful one indeed, we can see the individual crystals and molecules that make up that particular snowflake. We know that that snowflake is made up of a compound of what? Atoms. Each individual atom formed into a shape which is crystalline in structure, we call a snowflake. crystallized water. But if there's an atom there, we know that an atom is formed by the movement of proton, neutron, and electron. An electron is circumnavigating in a Gaussian cloud around the nucleus of a proton and neutron. Well, if the electron is moving around that nucleus at an extremely high rate of speed, faster than the speed of light, mind you, a speed so fast that we cannot calculate where it precisely is, but we can say that it's moving so fast that it is in two places at one time, then there must be some degree or form of heat as a result of that movement. Well, what happens when you place many things near each other that are moving at a great rate of speed? Well, if ice is made up of atoms and these atoms are moving, there is heat present. Therefore, since there is heat present, why is it crystalline in structure? It is that crystalline structure which creates the snowflake. But there are still atoms there. They are moving. So there's heat present. So is it cold? Our senses are able to perceive. Since there is heat present in every atom of light, since there is heat present in every solid structure, be it wood, rock, or stone, atoms are present. Because we can touch it. We perceive it with our eyes, with our hands. There is heat present. But because of our perception of the degrees of heat, we call that cold. But there is heat present. And our unit of measure of heat, we use the Fahrenheit system, where minus 32 degrees Fahrenheit, ice crystals begin to form. We're saying it's cold outside. No, there's just less heat than we're comfortable with. Other units of measure more precise than the Fahrenheit system, at 0 degrees Kelvin, all atomic motion stops. There is no heat because there is no movement. To perceive numerically what that is, talking about minus 479 degrees Fahrenheit, where true absolute 0 degrees in temperature exists. Absolute zero. Excuse me. So when we say it's cold outside, we're not using a scientific term that represents an actual function of nature. We're using a term of perception that is either comfortable or uncomfortable. Perception. So to say a thing is cold is not precise, nor is it accurate. Because if the thing is there, then there is heat present. We're just not able to perceive it through the construct of our perception or our ability to understand the degree to which we are exposed. What is it? Is it real and doesn't exist? So to the listeners, 60,000 or so that have children, and your child comes up to you and says they have to give a definition of cold, you tell that child, in scientific terminology, precisely exact, there is no such thing as cold. But I can give you a definition of the perception of what cold is. But I cannot give you a definition of what cold is exactly, because it does not exist. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, coming to you live from the city of Detroit. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. So as we begin to close out this edition of Not So Mad Science, the honor of closing out this program falls on my 7-year-old.
This is Not So Mad Science with your host. With your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, on the Black Hole Radio Network in the city of Detroit.
We'll be right back next week, where we're going to discuss at 6:30 chemistry.
Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.
Hey!